The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Getting buildings built can be a steep climb. Developers can spend months, even years, canvassing local officials, boards, and residents, and still end up scrapping their plans. After 39 public hearings, an Islamic group in New Jersey charges that the approval process for a proposed mosque has become Kafkaesque. Bernard's Township is just one in a growing number of towns using zoning laws as barriers to new mosques and Islamic schools. It's now being sued for discrimination by the Justice Department. Mark Goldfeder is senior lecturer at Emory University School of Law and senior fellow at the University Center for the Study of Law and Religion. Joins us now with more on how this and similar cases could fare under the incoming Trump administration. And Mark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much.
So the Justice Department is now involved in 13 cases under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. First, fill us in on the act and its origins.
Sure. Before the Religious Land Use Act, easier to call it RLUPA, was passed, Congress actually held 9 hearings over the course of 3 years, and they found massive evidence of widespread discrimination against religious institutions by state and local officials in land use decisions. And they found in particular that minority religions were being singled out. To put that into context, though, you know, the right to build, buy, or lease a place for worship is very much a part of the religious freedom that this country tries to protect. And the problem is that zoning laws are a very easy place to potentially hide discrimination. And that's aside from the fact that there's all kinds of arcane laws and minutiae that has to be worked out. It's not entirely true that every single church and every single institution has to have the same zoning laws. For instance, one thing that came up in the New Jersey case that you were describing was parking. It might not be unreasonable or unfair to say that parking for a mosque needs to look different than parking for a church, because one holds a main service on a Friday and one holds a main service on a Sunday. People may be coming in one car as a family on Sunday or in separate cars on Friday, which means you might need more parking spot. And so the very idea that religious institutions might be different opens up the door for different kinds of treatment. The problem is once you have differential treatment, it becomes very easy to hide discriminatory differential treatment. And so to address those concerns, Congress unanimously passed RLUPA, which prohibits zoning and landmark laws that substantially burden the religious exercise of churches or other religious assemblies, unless implementing those laws is the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling governmental interest.
Okay, now this passed unanimously by Congress in 2000, of course, before September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Building permits, of course, get turned down all the time. Is there clear evidence of anti-Muslim sentiment in the cases currently underway with the Justice Department?
Well, there's definitely smoke, and I won't say that there's definitely fire, but there's definitely smoke in those cases. In New Jersey, there was vociferous public opposition. There was emails that have gone between board members that were filled with some anti-Muslim references, and even at the hearings themselves, some people had spoken up and said things. Now, to their credit, the township and the board did immediately shut down people who said things, but the fact that the town members were coming out and saying those things did hint at the fact that there might be something behind it.
What are the other reasons the town gave for refusal? You mentioned parking.
Parking was one of the main ones. They thought that a mosque and the way that it was set up needed to have an additional set of parking spots that other groups did not have to have. Over the course of 39 different hearings, they said that the society had taken some pains to try to make sure that it met with everything that they were asking for. So the zoning, for instance, code required 3 acres for a house of worship. They bought 4. They hired an architect to make sure that it fit in with the station. It wouldn't have the traditional dome, and they had minarets that looked like chimneys so that it wouldn't actually stand out at all. And so they did work hard to try and make sure that it fit with all of the various design issues that the township had raised. And again, the township claims that the applicant's faith did not play any role in their decision, and they were just concerned about simple things like parking. What makes these kinds of issues so difficult is that on its surface, that's a legitimate claim. And the only time that it becomes clear is when you find the smoking gun. Now, in this case, you can argue that they found the smoking gun because they have those emails expressing concern. There were some emails that, according to the Justice Department, were collusion between the various board members trying to make sure that they hid their discriminatory behavior behind non-discriminatory statements. But without that kind of smoking gun, it's not illegitimate to assume that a mosque might require different parking. And so, again, that's why you need an RLUIPA, which allows the Justice Department to look into these things, because without it, it would be so easy to hide discrimination.
11 of the 13 current cases under RLUIPA do involve Muslims. Do you know anything about the other cases and claims by those towns or why they turned down permits?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting to point out that in the town of Bernard, there was another church that was actually turned down recently after only two hearings. And the town wants to point to that one to say, well, it's actually the case that sometimes religious institutions are turned down. It has nothing to do with religious faith and is not necessarily anti-Muslim. But you are right that there's been a rising sentiment, especially in the last 15 years, of these sort of anti-Islamic institutions. But the truth is that when RLUIPA was passed, they found that, for instance, I believe it was only 2% of the population in the United States was Jewish, but 20% of the zoning cases involved synagogues. And so it's not entirely true that it's always about Islamic influences, but it certainly in the last 15 years seems to have shifted that way.
Donald Trump's nominee to head the Justice Department is Senator Jeff Sessions. Will these cases proceed, do you think, with Sessions at the helm of the Justice Department?
I think they will. And I think that, honestly, I think people are reading too much into those kinds of affiliations. So, for instance, in the Justice Department's questionnaire that they sent out in Bernard, they were asking people what their associations were with Donald Trump. The truth is that that town overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton. And so I think it's not necessarily the case that a person's political affiliations will influence it one way or another. Even if Donald Trump were to implement any of his immigration, questions, that the leader of the Bernard Mosque movement here is the former mayor. He's a citizen. This is not the kind of people that Donald Trump, potential, quote-unquote, potential problematic immigrants that Donald Trump was talking about excluding. These are people who are good citizens who are here already. So I do think that they'll still have the same RLUIPA protections, and I would expect Jeff Sessions to fully protect them in the way that his predecessors have.
Mark Goldfeder, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Goldfeder, he's a lecturer at Emory University School of Law and senior fellow at the university's Center for the Study of Law and Religion. We read about federal discrimination lawsuits involving mosques or Islamic schools in a piece reported by Lisa Federaro for the New York Times. Congestion, capacity, distribution zone, those yawn-inducing terms, which could apply to traffic infrastructure, also belong in the energy industry lexicon. Here's another one you may have heard, net metering. Net metering is associated with solar power and is the subject of big policy battles happening all over the country. And though it might sound a bit boring to non-energy types, Sam Evans-Brown is an energy type, and he's here to tell us why net metering is important and interesting. He's host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, which is about the natural world and how we use it. The latest episode is all about the accidental origins of net metering. And Sam, so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me in.
So Sam, my job as a host is to be interested in these kind of conversations. So you've convinced me, now you have to convince our listeners, why is net metering fascinating?
Well, so net metering is the bedrock, the sort of wonky bedrock of the American rooftop solar power industry. Every state where you see solar panels on people's roofs has net metering, and without it, they wouldn't exist. And it may sound like it's an indecipherable term, but the words are there, net metering, right? So the meter is the thing that's on the side of your house that counts how much electricity you've used, and net as in net versus gross. So if you have solar panels on your roof, they can feed backwards into the grid. Your meter runs backwards. And then if you're buying electricity, then the meter runs the other way. And then at the end of the month, you just get billed for wherever the needle ends up.
And when the needle goes backwards, it goes back to the power company.
Yeah, in a way. It sort of goes to your friends and neighbors, basically, and then you get paid for it.
That's a very charitable way to look at it. Not everybody has that view. But you actually tracked down the first example of net metering. So what was the story?
So I had this kind of intuition that net metering didn't have a particularly, let's say, academic beginning, because it just seemed like such a strange way to pay for something that, oh, we're just going to take your meter and we're going to run it backwards. I mean, nothing else in the utility industry works that way. And so when I started to dig around, I found that indeed that is the case. It began with a guy named Stephen Strong, who was an architect back in the 60s. He was an engineer for an oil pipeline company and decided he was going to strike out and start a solar company. The very first instance of net metering was on top of a subsidized housing project in which they had slapped a bunch of solar panels up there. And without asking anybody's permission, they wired them up so that they could run backwards onto the grid. And so here's, we actually have a clip where you can hear him telling that story.
I mean, did you talk to the utility at all? Did you show them your design and say, this is what we're going to do?
No. The developers... they said, don't worry about that. You just get the technical side of this done and get it working, and we'll take care of it. We're going to be interfacing with the utility. It turned out that they didn't say anything about the system to the utility purposefully. So when the system was complete and ready essentially to start up, one of the brothers came up into the mechanical penthouse on the top of the building and said, well, how are we doing with the solar, Stephen? I said, well, it's ready to go. We just need to get permission from the utility to interconnect with the grid. And he threw the switch and he said, that's okay, we'll take care of that. And told me at the time, there's one thing in your career that you should learn early, and that is it's easier to ask forgiveness than it is to ask permission.
Whoa, gorilla move there.
Well, then the way they wound up asking permission, quote unquote, was to invite all sorts of heavyweights to the ribbon cutting. And so once all these, you know, people from the federal government and congressmen and senators had said their piece about how great and forward thinking this building was, then the utility executives had to stand up and say their piece. And they're not about to say, you know, this is a travesty that could undermine our entire business model. They just said nice things and moved on with their lives.
Well, especially since it's on low-income housing, you know, we think of solar as a real privilege right now.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. It doesn't have to be. You know, you can think of ways that you could structure, you know, agreements where all you'd have to do is sign on to an existing project, and it shouldn't cost you a huge amount of capital. I mean, energy isn't that expensive, and the cost of solar has fallen so much that it is quite competitive. It's just this question of how do we pay for the grid that delivers the solar to you that has turned out to be a sticky one.
Okay, so outline of why it's a sticky issue and why it's such a big debate now. Then this was what, back in the 70s when he did this?
Yeah, and so it's become a debate now because we're getting to the point where enough solar power is being net metered that the utilities are starting to say, wait a second, there are some downsides to this for us. And if you think about it, if you were to carry this to its logical, you know, conclusion, well, sort of theoretical logical conclusion, where if everyone had solar panels on their roof and everyone wasn't paying an electric bill, there would be no money to pay for the grid that would deliver those electrons to your friends and neighbors.
Can you break that down for me a little bit more, the pros and cons of how this works?
So the solar industry says that it's beneficial because it's, you know, at this early stage, it's all this generation is happening at a time that's really problematic for the grid. It's sort of shaving off peak hours. But what the utilities have been saying is that, you know, if you do this too much, you're going to be shifting the cost of maintaining the grid. So I spoke with Michael Harrington, who, you know, he's a legislator in New Hampshire, a former electric utility regulator, and he made this point really eloquently.
It's a taking from the not so people that have not so much and giving it to people who have more. Say I was a retired school teacher in Manchester living in an apartment. There's no way I'm going to put solar panels on that apartment roof and get any benefit from net metering, but I'm going to have to pay for it because some guy in Bedford, I just use Bedford as an example, got nothing to do with a problem with Bedford, but he might have a 4,000 square foot house. And he says, boy, if I do this net metering thing in 5 or 6 years, I'll be getting basically free electricity. But if I'm living in a mobile home or an apartment building or a small house, or even if I'm just someone who says, I'm worried about paying my mortgage for the next 5 or 6 months, not that I'm going to be able to make money 6 or 7 or 8 years from now after I break even. So it's a reverse distribution of wealth from the way we normally do things in the United States. And I don't think that's right.
That's Michael Harrington speaking there with Sam Evans Brown for the Outside In podcast. Sam is with me, and he's discussing the scintillating topic of net metering. And it actually is getting more exciting as the moments go on.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I like
it's
how
kind of
got...
in the net metering way. It's getting bigger and bigger, almost going backwards.
Yeah. I like how he got the term congestion into the upfront. That's one of my favorite energy terms.
So his point is this benefits people who can afford it, less the school teacher on a pension or someone living in a mobile home.
Yeah, and this is the argument that the utilities have made, is that most solar owners are in fact people of above average income, and there are many studies that can show that to be the case. Again, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but certainly that is the way things are now. So then, if that is the case, if people who can least afford it are going to wind up shouldering the costs of paying for the grid, that is eventually going to be a problem and something that a lot of regulatory reformers are looking to head off at the pass.
So the policies on this, I guess, vary from state to state. How about here in New Hampshire? What's the conversation? Why are we in this discussion?
So right now we're in the midst of a proceeding in the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, the hallowed halls of the PUC, one of my favorite places to hang out if you need a nap at any point in the day. But the outlines of the battle here in New Hampshire look a lot like the outlines in every other state, where you have the utility saying that solar should get paid the exact same way that every other power plant gets paid, which is to say they sell into the wholesale markets. You know, those costs are then absorbed and turned into retail rates, as opposed to this weird let's run your meter backwards business. And then you have the solar providers on the other end of the debate saying, don't touch it, just leave net metering alone. Without it, you're going to kill all the jobs in our industry. And then you've got a bunch of stuff in the middle, which is basically just sort of tweaking the number. You know, if the solar people are saying we should get paid 17 cents and the utilities are saying you should get paid 6 cents, they're sort of middle of the ground proposals to say, OK, let's go with 12. But then, you know, I got really excited about some of these more radical ideas that maybe the whole way that you should pay for electricity should change, where instead of just taking all of the costs of the grid and all of the costs for the energy generated that goes across it, you know, adding them up, dividing them by everybody and averaging it all out into one sort of, you know, not particularly reflective number, what if you were to encourage people to pay the cost of energy as it is? Because once you learn anything about the grid, what you know is that the price of electricity from moment to moment varies wildly.
Based
on demand, yeah. And there are times even where the price is negative, where power plants will pay you so that they don't have to shut down. And then it goes all the way from those negative prices up to, you know, thousands of dollars per megawatt hour, which is, you know, hundreds of times what it normally costs in times of really high demand when you've got everything on the grid cranking at full power and you've got to turn on the jet fuel combustion turbines just to keep the lights on.
So what are these radical proposals that you mentioned?
So the one that I like the most, and, you know, I'll say with some caveats here that there are reasons to be skeptical about this idea. It is so different that we don't know what, you know, what technology problems we might encounter on the way to it or you know, how much it would cost just to roll out the infrastructure to make this possible. But those caveats aside, I like the idea of every hour you would have a new price for electricity, and every home would have a little display on the wall that would tell you what is the price this hour. That price could have a cap so that you weren't exposed to the real, you know, the real brutality of the wholesale market, but that would mean that you would, you know, you just think about it.
You'd be a lot more conscious of what was going on in those peak hours, what, 2 to 8 or something in the afternoon?
Yeah.
When people are going home, cooking dinner, putting on the television.
Exactly.
That is when you most want to use power, but it should cost the most.
Right. And think about the things that you'd be willing to do at a different time if you had a signal that it would save you money to do it. You know, think about running your dryer. Doesn't matter when you run your dryer. You could just set it to go in the middle of the night, for instance, and you can take the clothes out in the morning. You know, running your dishwasher the same way. There are businesses that could make money off of this. So you could have people selling you, you know, a little widget that you'd stick on your hot water heater, and it would tell your hot water heater to only turn on when prices are really low.
Is anybody working on this? I mean, is this the future of net metering?
Well, actually, it's funny. There was a pilot that was rolled out in the New Hampshire Electric Cooperative, so mostly northern New Hampshire, and they ran into lots of problems with the smart meters that they installed on people's homes that would enable this kind of price signal, and they had to put the brakes on their pilot and say, you know, they're actually suing the manufacturer of the smart meter until they get it all worked out. So people are trying it. It's very new. There are lots of kinks to be worked out before these things can happen.
Sam Evans Brown, he's host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, which, by the way, Outside Magazine named Best Podcast of 2016. Thank you so much for schooling us in net metering.
Thanks for soldiering through.
You can listen to the full episode about this subject at outsideinradio.org, or you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. Music in this episode came from Ari De Niro and Blue Dot Sessions. There is a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And do us a favor and rate the podcast, because everything goes that much further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.